things get a little bit grim. But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah!
That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour.
Well, shit.
How y'all doing?
What y'all doing?
Feel like y'all screwing.
Or probably driving in your car on your way to work.
Hopefully the world has opened up by the time that this comes out and y'all can go to work.
I would like to say with confidence that the world is just back to normal by the time this comes out.
I sure as shit hope so.
Sure. Well, shit.
Well, shit.
Hi.
Oh my gosh.
Hi.
Taylor.
Jenny.
Welcome to A Little Bit Grim.
Welcome. Thanks for coming back. If you've listened before, welcome. If you're new.
If this is your first episode, how the hell are ya?
Sit on down, friend. We got shit to tell you.
I gotta tell ya, we should probably just jump into this because this is a fucking doozy.
We did not, like, we knew early that true crime was probably going to be a struggle for me because I'm detail-oriented and I'm research-oriented. So I knew that my stories were going to be long, but this went off the rails a little.
I also
smidge
went off the rails.
So
with
when
mine.
Jenny and I got together tonight, we sat down, we had dinner, we had spaghetti. Jenny is an amazing cook, so every time I come over, she makes me dinner, and she canceled on me this week. Okay, she canceled me on me on Tuesday, and I was like, "But what am I gonna eat for dinner?" That was my first thought. So I was like, "Well, shit, I don't have somebody to cook for me."
Oh,
so. Tonight I got spaghetti. It was amazing and delicious. But
that is the kindest thing. That's the best compliment anybody could give me, that I cook well.
Oh my god. I dream of Jenny's cooking. It's so good.
You're so kind.
And we sat down, we were eating our spaghetti, which, like, spaghetti does not even do this justice. So I don't know. What did you call it? Tell us the name.
It is a robust tomato with pan roasted sausage deglazed with Chardonnay. Cream Ugh. Sauce
it and spaghetti
does things to my insides that are all good. Okay, so we sat down and I was like, okay, I am so sorry, this is gonna be a long ass episode. And Jenny was like, yeah, I went down the same rabbit hole, so we're sorry. I hope that you have a long drive ahead of you.
I hope you're like traveling like at least 2.5 hours away.
Yeah, we saved you on the last episode, though, because that only ended up being like 45 minutes.
So yeah.
I think we bought ourselves an extra like 15 or so.
So here you go. This is what it is. And I have to say, let me start off by giving somebody a little shout out.
Yeah.
Little Miss Quinn.
Hey, girl. Hey.
Hey, girl. In our Facebook group, we got down a rabbit hole of, like, what state has the highest homicide rate per capita.
Yeah.
And it was Louisiana and South Carolina. So I was like, oh, I'm going to do a swamp murder. And so I just Googled murders in Louisiana, and I stumbled across this, the Jeff Davis 8, or otherwise known as the Jennings 8.
Okay.
And it was a series of murders between 2005 and 2009 that happened, and it was like suspected serial killer. And I'm like, oh, just a little lighthearted serial killer.
Yeah, nothing big.
Wrong. Wrong. So wrong. I am now in a spiral of, let me tell you. This story is packed with so many concerning details regarding police negligence that it almost seems fiction. It sounds like a story. I'm going to try my best to, like, communicate these horrifying crimes in a sensical way. I'm not making you any promises.
Okay.
I am the right brain and Taylor is the left brain. She does the facts. I do the emotion.
Yeah.
Most of these details and a lot of this I got from a very in-depth Rolling Stone article.
Interesting. Okay.
With Ethan Brown.
Okay.
Who is the author of Murder in the Bayou.
Oh, that sounds like an amazing read.
It is the legally put as like fiction.
Oh, okay.
But non-fiction interview of this case.
So it's in the library. You'd find it in the section, fiction section, not the Dewey Decimal.
You probably
section.
Wouldn't find it in the library. And oh. We'll talk about why.
Interesting.
So before I delve in, I feel like it's so necessary for me to name these victims.
Yeah.
So we have Loretta Lewis, Ernestine Marie Daniels Patterson, who was 30 years old. Mm. Laconia Brown was 23 years old. Crystal Shea Benoit Zeno is 24 years old. Chris and Gary Lopez, 21. Whitney Dubois, 26. Brittany Gary, 17. And Nicole Gilroy, 26.
Do we know how old the first victim was?
Late 20s. Okay. 28.
Got it.
Ish. So, let me just give you a brief warning. This is my soapbox.
Okay.
That these women lost their lives in a long-winded fucking hot mess of a crime spree. They were sex workers on the fringe of society in an impoverished community. And I feel like we as a whole so frequently neglect these people who really need the most support and work done in anonymity and out of the public eye has no regulation. And oftentimes our sex workers are forced to put themselves in unnecessary risk just to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And sex work is work.
Mm-hmm.
And we as a modern society owe it to these humans to allow them to make their living in a safe environment.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be something that is a fringe society that's at risk.
Haven't we learned that, like, saying it's illegal isn't ever going to stop anybody from doing it?
No, in fact, people are going to do it harder and with, like, more rigor than ever before.
Especially if they're you and I. We're those people. Yeah. Who, if somebody tells me not to do it, we're going to fucking do it.
Yeah.
So these eight women were murdered between 2005 and 2009. And they all had an involvement with drugs or sex work of some sort.
Okay.
Several, if not all, were police informants.
Oh my God.
And three had relations with the same man named David, who went by Bowlegs because of a gunshot wound that left him with a limp.
Okay. All right. All right. Good old Bowlegs.
Good old David Bowlegs.
I would love to hear somebody say that with, like, the deep South Louisiana accent.
Bowlegs. I remember one of the most hurtful comments I ever heard was somebody in middle school called me a bow-legged bitch, and it was, like, very painful.
That's hurtful.
I know. My legs are not bow-legged.
No. I hope whoever that is, like, lies awake in the middle of the night and, like, wakes out of a dead sleep and is like, I can't believe I said that to Jenny.
I promise you, she does not. So, all of the bodies of these eight women were dumped in crawdaddy ponds and channels and bayous throughout the Jefferson Davis Parish. The first victim, Loretta Lewis, was found floating in a river by a fisherman in late May 2005.
Okay.
Soon, more bodies would surface. Ernestine Marie Daniels Patterson had her throat slit, as did Laconia Muggy Brown. Crystal Shea Benoit?
Yeah.
Zeno. Chris and Gary Lopez, Whitney Dubois, Brittany Gary, and Nicole Gilroy were so badly decomposed that the cause of death was undeterminable, but asphyxiation was said to have played a key role.
Okay, I have a question. You might cover this, so stop me if that's on the path. But were they so badly decomposed because of the age or because of the environment?
The environment accelerated, and they weren't able to necessarily determine an exact time
of death.
Correct.
Okay.
And that really attributes to this long timeline of bullshit.
Shitstorm. Right. Got it.
So for years, the police implied that a serial killer was in the midst of the parish. But over a decade since the killings began, the case still remains unsolved. The investigation is plagued with missteps, lost and missing evidence, purposefully missing evidence, crime scene contamination due to police negligence. Ethan Brown, who wrote Murder in the Bayou, first heard of these murders in an article in the New York Times while working as both an investigative journalist and a private investigator in New Orleans. His interest was piqued, and he traveled down to Jennings to dig deeper into the situation.
I love an investigative journalist.
You love it because that's your dream of all dreams.
If I could do it over again.
You could do it now.
Two things. I would be an investigative journalist or a wedding planner.
Oh, you would be such a fucking amazing wedding planner.
I would leave everything behind if I thought Disney needed another wedding planner.
Your wedding
honestly was my favorite wedding that I've ever been to. You did a fantastic job.
Thanks. I liked it. It was all right.
You would recommend, do it again.
Breakfast for dinner all the way.
Yeah. Oh, yes. That wasn't even like in my list. Everything else was so beautiful. I forgot about breakfast for dinner, which is a superb choice.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Anyway, back to horrible.
So, Brown went to Jennings interview these people. And his investigations revealed that there are multiple suspects. Therefore, it is not the work of a serial killer. Police witnesses have named members of the local law enforcement as suspects in the case. Oof. Halfway through his first trip to Jennings, which lasted a week, he met with our old friend, mm-hmm. Mr. Bowlegs.
Yeah, okay.
And they were sitting out. They were talking. The sun was setting right when he got there. And after learning that he, Mr. Bowlegs, was intimate with three of the eight women.
So sorry, Donut. You almost hit pause.
Donut, again, as always, is on his worst fucking behavior.
I have the laptop in front of me, and he just, like, leapt with all 20 pounds of him, like, directly on the keyboard. So I grabbed him, and he was not happy.
This is going to be a donut episode, I can tell.
Hi, bud.
So he met with him at sunset. He learned that Bowlegs had been intimate with three of the eight women.
That's a high percentage.
Correct. It is. This town only has 10,000 people in it. We grew up in small towns.
Yeah.
We know our towns were smaller than this town. So we know what people know. Uh-huh. People know everything.
Yep.
And nobody will talk.
Zero secrets. Secrets like outside of the community. Like you'll never know what's going on inside of the community, but everybody inside the community knows.
Correct.
Because we're all trying to protect each other.
Correct. And especially when the police are so closely intertwined with this community, mm-hmm. there's some issues that arise. So he learned that he was intimate with three of the women in the case, and he confirmed additional connections that I'll talk about in a second. Ethan Brown awoke the next morning to the news that Bowlegs had been murdered just hours after.
What?
When Brown arrived at the crime scene, he was shocked to see that the crime scene had not been taped off, that the forensics team was working in there, and that there were people, a crowd, standing around, and they were walking into the house. In some of the instances, these people walking into the house who were not police were taking items out of the house.
This is like 2000s. Like, this is after Forensic Files. Like,
yeah,
guys, we know better.
He didn't read the article until after, like, 2011. So this is 2 years after the murders took place. And the sheriff's office still cannot properly contain a crime scene.
This makes me want to rip out all of my hair.
Mm-hmm. So later in the day, he interviewed with some local retired law enforcement who were present, for the murders before the Jennings 8. And he quoted them as saying, "Welcome to Jennings. I bet you've never seen anything like this before." Over the course of a few years, Brown made numerous trips back to Jeff Davis Parish, meeting with those connected in the case, eyewitnesses, friends, family of the victims. People had been brought in by the multi-agency task force that was assembled to help with the case. The task force is described as a near textbook example of conflict of interest. The investigative reports reveal a series of witness interviews in which local law enforcement agents were implicated in the murders, and statements from two female inmates portrayed suspects working with the sheriff's office to dispose of evidence in the Lopez case. However, the sergeant who took the statements was forced out of his job, and the allegations were ignored by law enforcement.
So what's the, like, in that situation, what's protocol? Is it get the next town over to handle your case? Is it, how are people?
I asked this same question to Ian when I was researching this. So if, let's say, here in Fort Wayne, the Fort Wayne Police Department are suspected of being
involved in a case.
Right.
Then there it's escalated to, like, the Allen County Sheriff and then to the state. There's, okay. like, a IAB, like, Internal Affairs Bureau who investigates claims.
Okay.
Like this. However, this circle is so small and tight, it doesn't look like it ever really got out to the state level.
Wow. Okay. So that shows you how tight-knit this community is.
Correct. And tight-knit in the people who are in power. It's a really... I would say, like, financially diverse,
okay.
but not so diverse, where there's a group of people who have all the money and all the power, and then these poor, like, impoverished people mm-hmm. on the other side of town who, it's just like a dichotomy that you see in small towns like this.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
So, many of those interviewed by Brown were regulars of the Boudreaux Inn. Okay. It is a now vacant motel. That housed the sex workers, drug dealers, users, and clients of our 8 women who were murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Brown used the state's public record laws to pour through thousands of legal documents and statements and police personnel files and building liens. And it was soon apparent that this was not the work of a serial killer, but instead a timeline of escalating police negligence and misconduct by the sheriff's office. The motel was co-owned by one Martin P. Gilroy.
Mm-hmm.
Who was a field representative of Louisiana Congressman Charles Boutsny. And it was soon learned that Boutsny was not only present at the inn on numerous occasions, but was a client of 3 of the Jess Davis 8.
Okay. Was it the same 3 that this other guy knew?
No.
Just different?
Just different. Okay. Same group. Same group, but...
3 different clients.
3 different clients.
Okay.
So, speaking of strange connections, there are more in this case that I can really list in, like, an accurate amount of time.
Okay.
Chris and Gary Lopez and Brittany Gary were cousins by blood.
Okay.
Brittany Gary lived with Crystal Benoit at the time of her death.
Okay.
I mentioned earlier that all of the 8 women were informants for local law enforcement.
Right.
And they frequently provided information to police about the other Jess Davis 8 who were murdered. And then those women who informed were soon killed and found.
Wow. Okay. All right.
So Kristen Lopez, one of the victims, was present when police shot and killed a drug dealer named Leonard Crochet in 2005.
All right.
Along with several individuals connected to the Jess Davis 8, including Alvin Bootsy Lewis,
okay.
who fathered a child with Whitney Dubois, and is the brother-in-law of the first victim, Loretta Chasson Lewis.
Such a small town.
The smallest.
Everyone is related to somebody in some way, shape, or form.
Yes, and has some kind of...
personal
tie
and probably like if they go down I'm going down too, so everybody's like and a high tide raises the ships.
Correct. And that's what this is that it looks like it started off small, and then the longer this went on, more people found out the truth, so more people needed to die, and then there's a larger cover-up.
Oh my god.
So a grand jury investigated the shooting and determined that there was no probable cause for a charge of negligent homicide against police, even though a Louisiana State Police investigation into the Crochet shooting concluded that he was unarmed when he was shot to death by law enforcement.
Wow.
Witnesses told investigators that they believed the police had killed many of the victims because of what they knew about the shooting of Leonard Crochet, which happened before the first murder.
Hmm.
Sheriff's Office Chief Criminal Investigator Warren Gary was also accused of purchasing a truck that was suspected to have been used to transport a body for the purpose of discarding evidence. So if, let's say for whatever reason, somebody steals your car.
Yeah.
And then they go and they murder somebody in your car.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get your car back. That car goes to a police auction.
Yeah.
It is now evidence. It has been cleaned and it's returning back. And that money goes to the state.
Okay.
So this police officer at the evidence auction bought the truck.
Okay.
And then it was gone into the night.
Oh, no. Okay.
In 2009, the sheriff ordered that every investigator working the Jeff Davis 8 case be swabbed for DNA in response to the accusations against investigators. However, the office refuses to comment on the results of the DNA testing.
Wow. Can they do that?
They hold all the power. I guess. Who's there to hold them accountable?
I guess. This is terrifying. Okay.
Police have arrested and or issued warrants for the arrest of 4 people in connection with the case. 2 people were held on murder charges for months before being released due to issues with evidence. Evidence just walked up out of the room. It's gone.
Shocking.
We don't know where it is. We no longer have evidence that implicates you in the murder. You're free to go.
Oh my God.
Frankie Richard was a local strip club owner and suspected drug dealer.
Okay.
He admitted to being a crack addict and to having sex with most of the victims. He was among those last seen with one of the victims, Kristen Lopez. Law enforcement's own witnesses have connected Richard to the sheriff's office. The 2 female inmates who stated the sheriff's office disposed of evidence in the Lopez case alleged that the evidence was discarded at the behest of Richard.
Wow.
Byron Chad Jones and Loris Nixon, a cousin of Laconia Brown, the 5th victim, were briefly charged with second-degree murder in the Ernestine Patterson case, the 2nd victim. However, the sheriff's office did not test the alleged crime scene until, drumroll, 15 months after her murder. And they found that it failed to demonstrate the presence of blood.
Okay, hold on. So, body on the ground, crime scene. They didn't test the soil or anything like that. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, most of these were found in a lake or, but yes.
Swamp.
Swamp.
So they didn't test the nearby swampy areas.
For 15 months.
For 15 months for blood. Got it.
Okay. Let's keep.
I just wanted to make sure that I was being clear.
Oh no, you're being so clear. And let's keep in mind that this environment contributed to the rapid decomposition of the body. Of course, there's not going to be.
There's alligators there. No,
listen, alligators don't eat people. If you're dead or alive, if you toss like an alligator, they might bite you and chomp you, but like they're not going to eat you.
Really?
If you want to get rid of a body in a swamp, you have to adhere marshmallows to the human body and you have to cut holes in its abdomen. Otherwise, it'll float and it needs to like sink a little bit below the surface. And alligators like marshmallows.
Okay. If I ever despair, I want everyone to look into Jenny and see if I'm floating in a marsh somewhere with marshmallows.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. One, if we ever murder somebody, you're an accomplice. You're not the victim.
True.
2, I only know that because of Dexter.
I see. Okay. Like, we only know that Carol Baskin probably killed her husband because of sardine oil.
Those tigers, they snackin'.
I heard a thing that was like, instead of you're cruising for a bruising, can we start saying
you're asking for a basking? Yes, I approve.
It's going to be funny until quarantine's over. Like, that's the only thread of joy that we have right now is Tiger King.
It's sad when like a methed out tiger dude is like
what our joy.
The only thing that can distract you from what's going
the
on.
The terror of the world. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Anyway, so they tested the crime scene 15 months later, and we're like, no, there's no blood there. So numerous items of missing evidence were found.
Yeah.
And very obviously prevented testing to be done at all. So there's very clearly in this example, but also I feel like something that like permeates our society is that it's corruption and greed and too much power in the hands of too few people. And I'm not saying that the Jefferson Davis Parish law enforcement were contributing to the deaths of these women. I don't think they murdered. I'm not going to say that.
We're not going to say it out loud.
I'm not going to say it out loud. Kay. Not here on the internet.
Yeah.
I am saying that we have a whole kind of have created a problem that is now our responsibility to fix, where we sacrifice liberty for security and we have leaders who encourage and exacerbate the division of our people. So we're too busy fighting with each other to point our fingers at where the problem really lies.
Yeah.
So that is the very long, messy tumultuous tale of the Jeff Davis 8.
Oh my gosh.
And if you want like a better quality version of that, there's a Showtime special about it. There's a book about it. You can go read about it.
Go down the rabbit hole.
Go down on the your own. It's a long one, so enjoy yourself.
I'll probably go down it. I'll keep you posted.
Thanks.
My goodness. Okay, I mean, that's like good topic right now, though. Our government's trying to say we should all go back to normal right now.
Well.
And that's our economy, because our economy's on the line. But are we risking humanity? Like, are we risking lives to do that?
I'm too much of a conspiracy theorist, because I fall so heavily in the middle where I think the government's too big, man. I think the government frequently oversteps its bounds.
Oh, I agree.
In its regulation of its people. But also, we need to be aware of protecting ourselves and the people that we love and those around us who are vulnerable.
Yeah. I fall very much on the side of, I don't think the government is taking enough steps to keep the people safe. And I think the doctors are trying to do that. And the government's like, nah, man, we need to make more money. And we're going to end up sacrificing the old and the homeless in order to get our economy back. And then, like, we have to make a decision if that's okay or not.
Fair enough. I just don't like the government telling me what to fucking do with myself.
You don't like anybody telling you what to do.
No, it makes me mad.
I will listen to a medical professional over anybody in politics every day.
Oh, yeah.
Every day. So that's where I'm at. Like, I'm just trying to, like, listen to the people with PhDs. Not people who have been on reality TV. That's where I'm at in my life.
Very fair.
Here we are. We're not even at episode 10 and we're getting political. Welcome. Okay. I'm about to tell you a long ass story.
I think we all need a long ass story after that.
Whew. Okay. So I'm going to tell you about the bathtub killers from Canada. And I am shocked and surprised at how few sources I had to go on this. There's not a lot. It was a relatively highly publicized murder that happened in Canada, but the United States, like, news media didn't really get a hold of it until years after it happened.
Oh my God.
And that's because it revolved around two minors. And so Canadian law is much different when it comes to minors. So that is kind of like the start to our tale. The sources that I did use were The Class Project, How to Kill a Mother is a book by Bob Mitchell. I read this book in 2 days. So it was a fly-by-night kind of a adventure for me. Then there is an episode of Deadly Women on Investigation Discovery. And my personal favorite, and how I found this topic, was the 2014 film Perfect Sisters, starring Abigail Breslin and Georgie Henley. So, Abigail Breslin was in Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind.
Oh, right? I love that movie.
So, she's the little girl.
Okay.
And then Georgie Henley is in Chronicles of Narnia. She's the youngest sister. She's Susan.
I'm sure the movie Lucy is very good, but the books are amazing.
Lucy.
Okay.
So Beth and Sandra Anderson are sisters. They're born less than a year apart. They're 15 and 16 respectively in 2003. They also have a little brother named Bobby, and he is around 6. Beth and Sandra are incredibly smart and gifted girls. They are brilliant. Like, all of their teachers were like, we've never seen girls so smart, just sang their praises immensely. They spoke multiple languages, have amazing grades, and very high IQs that have been tested. So these girls, like, know what's going on. So as a child, Sandra, as the older sister, was introverted, didn't have a whole lot of friends, but by the time she completed her sophomore year, she was very popular, had a lot of friends, had kind of figured out that social construct. She had big dreams. She wanted to be a movie producer, a rock star, anything with a spotlight on her.
Oh, dream big, honey.
Yeah, she wanted to be rich and famous, basically. But
lifestyles, yeah, of the rich and the famous. Can we sing? Are we getting copyrighted?
I think if we sing it, it doesn't count.
No, that's because it's non-melodic.
Yeah, truly. Okay, so, but she also had, like, dreams of being, like, making a huge difference. She wanted to be, like, well-known and well-liked. So, among these dreams of being famous, like, rock star, movie producer, actress, she also wanted to be a paramedic. She wanted to be a writer, and her biggest goal was to win a Nobel Prize. So, big dreams.
Big dreams. Good.
Yeah. Beth was the younger sister, and she was more sensitive. Sandra described her younger sister as being a delicate flower, straight-laced, but sharp as a whip.
Ooh.
So.
Not delicate like a flower, delicate like a bomb.
Yes. Their mother, Linda, worked two jobs to keep the family afloat, but they didn't have a lot of extra money, and they often had to go without. Oh. The girls took care of their little brother and kept the house as well because their mom worked so much. The mother also almost always came home exhausted, and she just couldn't really look after the kids very well. In addition to trying to just make ends meet, she also had a major drinking problem and struggled with depression. Yeah. All of Linda's coworkers painted Linda to be kind, gentle, a good mother. They said that she sacrificed a lot for her children, and they always told stories of the sacrifices that Linda was making, but then Linda would tell them stories about how terrible her girls were. Uh-huh. So she told her coworkers that Sandra had stolen a savings bond that she had created for her, and that they were always out partying and all of this stuff. Oh. So it's just heartbreaking and hard to understand that, like, these girls were taking care of their little brother, and, like, so many people painted this picture of just differing sides of the story. So she basically said that the girls were out of control most of the time, and Linda was at the end of her wits. She just didn't know what else to do for them. Linda had to move Beth, Sandra, and Bobby around a lot, and they just went to crappier and crappier apartments. They didn't have anything nice or expensive, but they did live in a really nice area. So all of Beth and Sandra's friends had all the nice things. They all lived in houses with swimming pools and had Prada bags. And
oh, I bet that was so nice.
Wasn't that so fun? So they did not love that comparison. And they always felt like they were making that comparison, like the haves and the have-nots.
Sure.
But they were relatively, like, accepted by that peer group as being, like, one of their own. So it's okay. Not like they were completely ostracized by that society.
Perfect.
Linda often missed important events like doctor's appointments, parent-teacher conferences, and Sandra stood in for her mother on those occasions. So a 15-year-old girl was going to parent-teacher conferences for this kid. When Linda missed work because she was drunk, she was let go, and neither Sandra or Beth could do anything about it. That just, like, was their life. Linda blurred the lines between mother, party friend, and roommate. This was terrible, and I really debated whether or not to put this in, but to paint the true picture, I think, of what Linda put her kids through, it's going in. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Close your ears if you don't like this. Sometimes she was inappropriate, if not downright abusive, negligent. She would masturbate in the living room when the girls had friends over. She let Bobby play with her vibrators like a toy.
Oh, my God.
Rough.
Oh.
Really bad. The girls would come home, and she would be having sex with her boyfriends in the living room. She would forget what time it was, what day it was. So the girls were constantly trying to shield Bobby
from God.
That very adult lifestyle that he was six. Like, he doesn't need to be, like, shown any of that.
No, there's no reason that he should even be aware of that side of people.
Right.
Oh, ew.
Yeah.
Fucking hate it.
Gross.
That's fucking grim as fuck.
Yep. So Beth said all she ever did was sit around the house naked, drinking and smoking, soiling herself and hurting everyone. Linda would tell Beth and Sandra to go to bed at 3 p.m., like, as soon as they got home, she would say, go to bed, and I drink because of you. Horrible. Horrible. Beth and Sandra both dreamed of someday leaving, but couldn't bring themselves to run away because they would have to leave Bobby behind.
Oh, my stomach is in knots.
Yeah. In this whole story, Bobby is basically their moral compass. And everything they do had a basis in, like, trying to protect Bobby.
Sure.
And they both truly wanted to take care of him. Even how horrible the story gets, because, like, we're at the beginning.
You haven't even turned the page, and there's a stack of fucking pages there.
I'm so sorry. I read the entire book in 2 days.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, one day in the fall of 2002, Sandra had an idea. She wanted Beth's help, but she decided, like, I'm going to do this whether Beth wants to or not. But, like, it would be really nice to have, like, another person in this with me. I'm going to kill Mom.
Okay.
Okay. So, out the gate, Beth was on board with the idea of taking care of Bobby. She was very much like, yes, we need to take Bobby and, like, go.
Mm-hmm.
We need to, like, figure this out. Wasn't super on board with, like, the idea of murder. But it didn't take very long for her to come around to this idea.
Well, if that's the environment that you're living in,
yeah,
I can follow your train of thought.
Yeah. And keep in mind, like, at the like beginning of this idea, I believe they are 14 and 15, and by the actual act, they are 15 and 16.
Oh, so this is pretty premeditated.
Yeah. So obviously, part of the motive was to be rid of their alcoholic mother, but these girls are smart, so they've done their research. And they know that all three children would get $70,000 each if their mother's death was ruled accidental.
Oh.
So they repeatedly say that money was not the number one motive, but it was a bonus. So this is about where you're going to start to not feel bad for them anymore.
Okay.
So during initial conversations, they talked about getting, like, setting a fire and setting their mom on fire by having, like, if she passed out on the bed, pouring wine over her.
Sure.
And just, like, setting the whole thing on fire.
Oh, my God. I wonder if you're, like, super, like, remember us at Tequila Night?
Oh, God.
Like, I wonder if we were set on fire, if we would burn faster because of how much booze was in our body.
We were very flammable that night.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Oh,
we're not ready. Okay, continue on. Future Taylor, edit that out.
I can't talk about Tequila Night. Okay. Okay, so they decided that they would set her on fire. But after further conversations, they decided that that would be too gruesome and that they didn't want to hear their mother scream.
Ooh.
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 So, like I said, they're very smart. They did their research, and they decided that drowning would be the best way to go because it was an unspectacular way to die.
Yeah.
So these girls definitely had a fucked up life. They were thrown into adulthood very early. They had an intense need to be liked by their peers. They had a very 2000s goth girl vibe, like both of them did.
Okay.
They liked to party a lot. They smoked weed and drank alcohol at school, which was ironic because they wanted to kill their mother because they found her to be too far gone as an alcoholic. But they were also escaping their reality by drinking.
Well, of course they are.
At school.
Well, what's the only example of escaping their reality that they've had besides their mom doing the same thing?
Yeah. And their mom would buy them alcohol.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, their mom was just like, whatever you want. Like, that's fine.
How are there not teachers involved and, like, DCS and officials in this?
Okay. In this case already.
Go on.
So I will say, Sandra calls the Canadian version of DCS and basically says, like, things are really bad here, but she didn't have any proof. And so DCS comes, and by the time they got to the house, Sandra said, I don't know what you're talking about. Everything's fine. I didn't call you. I don't need you. Go away. So she calls again a year later. And is like, no, now it's really bad. And the caseworkers are like, okay, but, like, last time we came, and then you said you didn't need us. So, like, were you being coerced into saying that? What happened? And she said, yes, my mom told me to lie. And they said, okay, you need to document everything and call us back. And she was just like, nobody wants to help me.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Their need to be liked superseded any need for secrecy. So, they trusted a few friends with their ideas, schemes, and plans to murder their mother. There were 4 to 6 friends involved, like, intimately with this plan, but we're going to focus on 4 of them.
Okay.
So, there's 3 guys and a girl. There's Jay, Justin, Ashley, and Donnie. Donnie was Sandra's boyfriend, but he didn't know nearly as much as the others. I think Sandra realized that he was a good person and didn't need to be involved. Sure. But it was also like they were going through a rough patch. She didn't know if she really wanted to be with him anymore. She was just not trying to trust him a whole lot.
Okay, fair. You gotta be careful with who you trust when you're planning a murder.
Yeah, so he didn't find out about the murder until after it took place. Jay was Sandra's best friend, and Donnie was, like, never jealous of that relationship. He was just like, this is what it is. Like, they're best friends. They've always been best friends. Like, sure. this is what it is. But Jay was super deep involved in the planning. Ashley and Sandra are BFF, but Ashley didn't really like Beth that much. She thought she was annoying. Ashley had that, like, rebel cheerleader vibe. Think Quinn's weird character arc in, like, season 4 of Glee.
Okay, got it.
Like, she dyed her hair pink and was, like, smoking under the bleachers. Like,
yes.
That's Ashley.
Okay. She had a moment.
Yeah. She knew about the plan because she was curious. That, like, curiosity sparked in her, and she was like, I can't not know what's happening. Like, you have to tell me what's happening right now.
Oh my God, she's me. That's me. I don't want drama or bullshit in my life, but I have to know about everybody's drama and bullshit.
I know.
And then I take the secret and I hold it very close to my heart and I die with it. It's so gratifying to me to know people's deep, dark secrets.
That is not me. I want to know, and I will be like, actually, don't tell me.
Because you'll blab.
Because I will blab.
I will hold your deepest, darkest secrets close to my heart, and they give me validation.
It, like, is a crab that's clawing its way out of my soul. Oh, no. It needs to see the light of day. Don't trust me with shit. Okay, so, she offered some advice, but wasn't as deep in as Jay and Justin. Beth had a huge, giant lady boner for Justin, and he was also very deep involved in planning.
Okay.
So, yep. These girls were very smart. They had high IQs. They had zero common sense.
Nah, book smart, no real smart.
Not any real smart, because these dum-dums decided to have communication with these 4 people over MSN Instant Messenger.
Oh, my God.
Welcome to 2004.
Listen, I myself have gotten into a pickle on MSN Instant Messenger back in my day.
Yeah.
Not murder.
No.
Just other stuff.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God.
The internet was... Nobody knew. Internet was new. We didn't know about IP addresses and how you can track people and...
Yeah.
Nothing disappears.
No, nothing is gone.
No, it's on the internet. My MySpace is still floating around out there somewhere.
Oh, God. I haven't thought about that.
Yours is out there, too.
Please don't go look for it.
Oh, I'm gonna find it.
Oh, it's so...
What do you think your featured song is right now?
Probably Avril Lavigne.
That's fair.
Or Paramore.
Ooh.
It could be Misery Business, I won't lie.
Mine could be Flyleaf.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Or possibly Kill Paradise.
Okay.
Coheed and Cambria, maybe.
Oh.
But probably not.
I went through a Skillet phase.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's very off-brand for you, and I love it.
Oh, yeah. I went through a hard Skillet phase. That could be it. Oh, no. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So.
MSN Messenger.
MSN Messenger.
I can see the green and blue butterfly in my mind now.
Oh, I am about to tell you their screen names.
Fuck yeah.
And I'm going to read, like, a lot. There is a stack of papers in front of me, but a lot of these are, like, conversations back and forth, so they're kind of short.
Okay.
So, in January 2003, Sandra and Beth have pretty much like the semblance of a plan together. Linda needed to die on a weekend when Bobby wasn't home, and alcohol had to play a crucial role. Oh, and don't forget the Tylenol 3s, which have codeine in them.
Hydrocodone, I think they're called now.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
The girls spent a lot of time on the internet trying to figure out the best mixture of alcohol and pills to slow their mother's heart rate down, so she would be able to put up less of a fight.
Oh.
Dark.
Oh.
So, January 2nd, 2003, this is a convo between Jay and Beth.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jay is Sandra's best friend, but he, like, knows both girls very well. Jay says, how's life getting any better? And Beth says, how would it? No, I'm still just peachy. Then Beth asked Jay if he would still be able to help with the alibi. Like, hey, bro, can you still help me with my alibi?
Like, Couch dog. What do you need?
My god. All right. Jay says, yeah, sure. Still planning that one out. And Beth says, yep, tub, drowning. Jay says, like, that's one of the worst ways to go, though. And Beth says, fell, hit head, drown, sleeping pills. She won't be able to move. Jay says, okay, because you can't just leave any marks on her, like pressure of your hands on her.
Yeah.
Beth says, I know. No shit, dipshit. Jay says, shut the fuck up. I'm trying to help. Because, like, even the slightest pushing on her, people could probably tell.
Oh, good thing her best friend is a forensic scientist.
Yeah, good to know. Beth says, thanks for crediting me with so much intelligence. It's obvious, damn it. Ugh, poor, sweet little 15-year-old. So this conversation continues with plans and ends with them making plans for the Friday before the murder. You know, just your average run-of-the-mill getting drunk and getting high.
Wow.
Yep.
Sure.
Easy transition.
Perfect.
Into Friday plans. Okay, so we fast forward about 2 weeks to January 13th, 2013. And this is between Beth and Justin, the guy she has a crush on. And they talk through some of the issues with having the water running in the bathtub. Because they can't leave the water running. So if they did leave the water running, it would flood their townhouse and flood the basement, which is where Beth lived. And she said, oh, yeah, we can't do that, my poor basement. Yep. She confirmed that he was still good to help with the alibi. Again, just like, hey, bro, you good? Can you help me with my alibi?
Yeah.
Like, they said the word alibi.
My fucking... Not twice
like,
now.
Yeah, not like, hey, man, can we meet at this restaurant at 7 o'clock on Saturday?
No.
Alibi. Justin asked if Beth... Okay, this part is fucked up. Justin asked if Beth could cry on a whim, because he could. He wanted to be there for when they discover the body after going to dinner. He said he could be very convincing. Justin, why not just say we're heading back to your place? I have a picture in my head of the three of us sitting huddled on the doorstep. It looks so convincing in my head. You two just sobbing. Me trying to act tough. My eyes watering. Sorry, I'm being dramatic. That side of me is coming out. Gross. They talked through more planning and Beth said, we're not going to be like, she looks drunk, into the tub. We're going to make sure she can't walk and can't possibly drink anymore and doesn't react to water on her face at all. And besides, head first, easier to hold her down. Justin then goes into graphic detail, which I have excluded, about what happens to a person when they drown. He talks about their capillaries, what happens to them. At the end of Justin's like super graphic detail, Beth says, beautiful. And in asterisks, wipes tears away. Like an absolute psychopath.
Oh, no.
Horrible. Okay. The next day, January 14th, at around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, this is between Sandra and Jay. Sandra says, so we're planning on doing something this Saturday, very hopefully. And Jay says, yeah, that's good, I guess. And Sandra says, no, I mean with my mom. And he says, yeah, I know. Sandra, so we can't get drunk on Sunday unless it doesn't work out. Because, you know, we're trying to kill our mom on Saturday. So,
yeah,
like,
so you
can't
get
drunk on Sunday.
Right. Because you're probably going to be, like, you know, in questioning or something.
Yeah. Like in mourning at very least.
Right.
To
can't
keep
get drunk
appearances.
On Sunday. We have to reschedule.
So then Sandra cut and paste a paragraph from a website about mixing medications with alcohol and the effect that it can take. Just like copy paste. Sandra, so we're going to give my mom like three Tylenol 3s or possibly more. Jay says, yeah, okay, ha ha ha, and then just leave her in the tub. And Sandra says, and go to Jack Astor's. And Jack Astor's is the restaurant they were planning on going to as their alibi. Sandra warned Jay that he needed to delete his log files of their conversations. And he said, don't worry, I've already disabled the autosave feature.
Nah. Then how do we have this conversation, mister?
IP addresses. It doesn't matter what you delete. Like, you can't delete the internet. You can't delete your shit. Sorry. No. That's not how this works.
No.
Honey. Okay.
Be better about your murder.
Jesus. Okay. So then the 17th of January 2003, which is the day before the murder, and 2 days before the end of the semester, all the students in class, they're in class, and they're getting ready to turn in their final papers. And the students all start joking around like, do I still have to turn in my final paper if I break a leg? What if I get the chicken pox? What if I get into a car accident? Everyone was laughing and joking around. The teacher's like, yes, you still have to turn in your paper. And when the laughter died down, a voice in the back of the room goes, what if someone close to me dies? And that would be Beth.
She's not very fucking subtle, is she?
No. Huh. Fucking teenagers. Okay. So January 18th comes around. Linda became inebriated throughout the day. She drank vodka and lemonade, as well as a few glasses of wine and several Tylenol 3 painkillers. As Linda drank, Beth signed on to MSN. Her username was Dearly Departed. Around 3 o'clock, Sandra noticed the computer was logged in under Beth's username, and she just, like, really quick saw that her best friend Ashley was on, so, like, didn't log out. She just hopped in. Mm-hmm. And she says, hey, it's Sandra. So are you coming to Jack Astor's? And Ashley says, oh, are you going? And Sandra says, yeah, we're going around 7. And this is when Ashley realizes what's happening. And she said, oh my God, are you saying what I think you're saying? And she said, no, nothing yet, in like an hour. Ashley said, is she trashed yet? And Sandra said, she's getting there. Ashley says, I think I have one thing to point out to you that I don't think you've considered. I can't believe I'm saying this, but have you thought about a time of death? And Sandra says, yep, we have Justin's alibi, plus we're leaving right after and coming home late. Ashley says, all right, because you can't be home at the estimated time of death, so you should leave within an hour of doing it.
Oh my God. What? Okay, listen. One, if your best friend is going to murder somebody, like, that's some fucking solid advice. But two, like, oh my fucking God.
They're children.
Oh God.
Yeah. It gives me heebs. Yeah. It gives me true, honest heebs. Okay, so Sandra says, yeah, I'm pretty sure we've thought of everything that we could. The conversation continues, and Sandra describes the feeling that she's having as getting ready to leave for vacation.
Oh, no.
Gross.
Big gross.
Don't like it.
Ugh.
So the conversation ends with Ashley giving one last piece of advice. And this stuck out to everybody who's heard this story. It's like a chapter in the book I read. It's like just titled this. I think the title of the Deadly Women episode is titled this. And Ashley just says, good luck. Wear gloves. Yikes. All right. So.
Taylor. Hold on. I hate it so much. Fuck.
It's horrible. They're 16. Good luck, wear gloves. Like, I'm... we're killing a human.
This is blatant disregard. Okay, but even... Listen, even if she... Like, there's so many other avenues to take.
Right.
Besides killing your mom.
Mm-hmm. So, in Canada, you can own a home at 16.
Okay.
So, Sandra's there.
Okay.
So, all she needs is a job. And she can own a home. So, fucking move out. They talk to their dad. His name's Walter. And
I didn't even think about that. Where the fuck is dad during this?
Dad has a new family.
Mm.
Dad's not super interested.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah. So dad's like not a lot of help. Linda, her sister's name is Martha, and Martha is unwilling to believe that Linda is a poor mother.
Okay.
But everything that I read made me think that if the girls were like, we need to live with you, Martha would have allowed that.
Yeah.
And we'll get to some of that. But they truly had other options.
Okay.
they had a lot of other things that they could have done other than kill their mom. So, after consuming 6 Tylenol 3s, several glasses of wine, and a full 26-ounce bottle of Absolute Vodka.
Oh!
Linda was nearly unconscious.
No shit.
I would be full-on dead.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I really, truly can't drink, like, more than 2 glasses of wine anymore. Quarantine has got me messed up. My tolerance is gone. But, oh, God. That is so much. So much. For even an alcoholic.
Even if somebody's, like, accustomed to pills, like, 6?
6. And what they kept doing was, they kept saying, like, she's too drunk and she's stupid. And they thought that they always thought that they were smarter than their mom. So they would, like, come in after a half an hour and be like, hey, mom, here's your pills. And she'd be like, oh, okay, cool. And she would take them and then she'd forget. And then they'd be like, hey, mom, here's your pills. And, like, she'd be like, oh, my God, you never party with me. This is going to be fun. And then she'd take 2 more. And that happened all afternoon.
Oh?
Mm-hmm.
My God.
Yeah. And Beth made the drinks all morning and all afternoon. So she knew exactly how much alcohol was going into her mom's system. Like, these girls were so smart in the fact that they measured everything. Like, they knew exactly how much alcohol it took. How many Tylenol 3s it took. This was not any type of, like, leave it to chance at all.
Oh, God.
So, at one point in the afternoon, Sandra and Beth suggested to their mother that she take a bath, and they led her to the bathroom. They undressed her and had her get into the tub. She got in with her head towards the faucet.
What?
But, I mean, she's wasted. Like,
I mean, okay.
Yeah. But they couldn't turn her around. So they were just like, okay. Guess that is what it is. They suggested Linda turn over. And Sandra knew that she had to hold her mother's head underwater for 2 to 6 minutes. And she just decided to split the difference and had Beth set a timer for 4 minutes. Yep. A timer.
Oh. Yeah. I wish you could see my face right now. Like...
The silence is shock.
Oh my fucking God.
Heartless.
These detail-oriented...
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I'm never speechless. I always got some shit to say. This is insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The meticulous details of this. Continue.
The bathroom was really small, so Beth had to stand behind Sandra while she did the act of murdering her mother.
Oh, my God.
During the murder, Sandra thought, this isn't what I expected. She expected some more thrashing, but really there was just twitching.
Well, she was
absolutely
obliterated.
Yeah, Linda did not put up a fight, and Sandra said it was easier than she expected. Horrible.
Mm.
Afterward, Sandra said that while she was holding her mother's head under the water, the phone rang, and Ashley had called to try to get them to stop. And Beth ran out to get the phone. And
no, don't answer the phone if you're not supposed to be there. You're ruining your own fucking alibi.
Well, she's talking to somebody who knows the alibi. But...
Well, all right.
So,
okay.
Basically, she leaves Sandra alone.
Oh.
In the bathtub. Oh, and God. Beth isn't in the room when their mother dies. So this creates a huge ripple in the, like, trust and the we're in this together type of a feeling, because Beth abandoned Sandra.
Okay.
In that moment because the phone rang.
Oh my fucking God.
Yeah. So the girls, once the act is done, the girls book it to the restaurant and meet up with their friends to establish their alibi. Beth was described as being chatty, good-natured, and flirtatious, while Sandra was withdrawn, stoic, and didn't need anything. They got home, and they called 911, and the operator tried to get them to perform CPR, but the girls didn't want to touch her. And those are quotes. Like, CPR, or the 911 operator is trying to get them to get her out of the bathtub. Okay. To at least, like, try to resuscitate her.
Oh, my God.
But, and the girls couldn't say, like, no, we know she's dead. But, so they panic, and they're like, we just don't want to touch her.
They're not the worst strategy. A lot of people handle shock differently.
Right. So, the 911 operator is like, but honey, don't you want to try? And you just hear crying. Like,
oh my God.
Horrible. So, when the police arrive, they don't suspect anything other than a few odd things in the bathroom. One, the head was pointing toward the faucets. Unusual, but there's no law against how you take a bath.
Oh, well.
The shower liner was not outside of the tub. It was still inside the tub. And the officers are like, don't you normally put this on the outside?
Yeah, but again, she was fucked up.
Yeah, again, no laws
right.
on how to take a bath. Like, right. People do shit differently. So that was just, like, noted as kind of odd, but that doesn't prove anything.
No.
And there was no sign of a struggle. So they thought if there was a struggle, she would have, like, knocked off all of shampoo bottles and stuff.
Oh, sure. Made a ruckus.
Yeah, everything is in perfect order. And the girl said that their mother drank a lot and often, and there was, like, the empty bottle. There was a glass by the bathtub with alcohol in it.
Oh, my God.
They did a blood alcohol test, but they did not do a drug test on Linda, like, for the autopsy.
Oh, God.
So they knew she was drunk, but they didn't know there was drugs in her system.
Fuck.
So the authorities believed the girls when they said it was an accident. And it was ruled an accidental death. Yeah.
And they got their money? Hold on, wait. I'll just let... Sorry. I'll let you finish.
I still have, like, 4 pages left. So, time moves very slowly for the girls after their mother's death. Sandra begins to drink more and more and do harder drugs. In addition to smoking pot every day, she's drunk in the mornings when she gets to school. And her friends know she carries a water bottle of vodka around with her. Not good.
No, not for a child.
Not for anybody.
Well, okay, like, fair. Okay, not for anybody, but especially a child.
Yeah, like, extra bad.
Yeah.
Like, I remember being in college, and there was one girl in one of my classes. I can't even remember what class it was, but I knew she had, like, alcohol with her in her coffee cup. And I remember being like, that's concerning. That's not what should be happening. But also, like, I guess you're an adult, so well, you gotta make those choices.
I remember trying to go to my psychology class once, but I was too drunk and I ended up throwing up in the basement of Keller.
I mean, we've all had, like, that one time.
We've had different college experiences, yes. You and I.
I was trying to be academic.
Yeah, I was drunk.
Well, yeah.
I also was academic.
Yeah.
But
yeah, you graduated.
I was drunk.
All right. Okay, so during this school year, records show that Sandra missed 35 days and 83 classes of school.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and Beth missed 24 days and 54 classes.
How was nobody alerted?
I don't know. Like, why are more people not concerned?
Right.
About what's happening here. Sandra began going to a lot of parties, and like I said earlier, her desire to be liked and viewed as interesting overwhelmed everything in her life. So that, compounded with the complicated emotions about killing her mother, made her tell every single fucking soul. All of them. About what she had done. The rumor mill starts spreading like crazy.
Oh, of course it does. It's high schoolers.
Yeah.
There's a murder most foul.
Yeah. And little girl over here has committed this murder.
Won't shut the fuck up about committing this murder.
Yeah. So she told a guy named Chad, bleh, everything one morning.
I hate it. I'm not sure I like a Chad.
I don't think I like a Chad.
A Chad is not a real person. You know when you meet real people and they're like dry toast and they're like, there's nothing. It's like they walk away from you out of your life and then they disappear into the abyss.
Okay, yeah.
Those are Chads.
No, I think Chads are the equivalent of like the Kool-Aid man who's like popping in through walls and shit like a bro.
I feel like that about Jacobs.
Oh, I don't feel that way about Jacobs. I like a Jacob.
Well.
I'm almost family with one.
Yeah,
partial. So, partial. Okay. So, Chad knows everything because one morning he was like, I'm going to walk you to school, like trying to be like cute. And she's like, okay, great. Well, she comes out of her house hammered at 8 a.m. And they walk and they're walking through like a wooded area to get to school and she passes out.
Oh my God.
On a log. And while she's like passing out, she's telling him everything. And he's like, what the fuck? And he is older than her. He's like 19 or 20.
Okay.
So he's not in high school. He was like literally just like walking her from her house to her school.
That's wholesome.
Yeah, cute. So he worked at a jewelry store and he was like getting ready to go into a shift.
Oh, God.
And he was like, I have a passed out teenage girl. I'm like late for my job. She just told me she committed a murder. Help. So he goes to his job and is like, I am so sorry. I have to take care of something. And so he goes back. He like left her in the forest because like.
Well, she'll be fine.
She'll be fine. 20 minutes. He comes back. He finds her. She's sleeping on the log where he left her.
Oh, sure.
And he carries her back to her house and like makes her repeat everything again to make sure that he's not mishearing things. And she told him the whole story again. And he was like. This is not like drunken girl ramblings. I'm concerned.
Like, this broad killed her fucking mom.
Yeah. So, we're going to move on to another wholesome little boy named David. She reconnects with David in the fall of 2003, so like 6 months after the murder. And they had been childhood friends. David knew Beth. He knew their mother. Like, their moms were friends.
Mm-hmm.
So David knew, like, all about her upbringing and all about the hardships that were there. David was a religious boy with a, like, strict moral compass. Like, he really felt like...
He was a good kid.
Yeah, like, right was right and wrong was wrong. And he had this huge crush on Sandra.
Mm.
Huge crush on her. He always had. And, like, through her spirals... Because he got to know her when she was, like, this cute little introverted...
Little precious baby angel thing.
And he saw her like spiral through all of these terrible things and he just felt like he was sent to her to help her.
Oh, ow, hold on, wait. That makes my heart feel the feelings.
Tingle.
Ow, no, not a... No,
a stab.
Yes, a stab.
It's not a tingle, it's a stab.
No, it's a stab and it hurts.
Okay. Right. So, he knew that she was very mentally unwell. And that she had often told him about committing suicide.
Well, she's in an incredibly tumultuous situation.
Right. And so his poor soul was just like, I can't let that happen. So David and Sandra talked over MSN and email. And she had alluded to doing something very bad. They met one day in person and she told him everything and she was not drunk when she told him.
Fuck.
And so he was like, what the fuck am I supposed to do with this? So he struggled deeply with this information, but he was mostly concerned that Sandra was going to kill herself. That was his biggest concern. So he confided her secret to his pastor, who encouraged him to go to the police. He didn't do it at first. He told other people, like, including his parents and a school guidance counselor. And the guidance counselor has a legal obligation to call the police.
Of course they do. I think that's something, when you're that age, there's something within you when you are in those gray areas where you test the waters by telling your peer group and then your parents and then an administrator to... see how far it has to go.
Right.
Okay. That's wild.
So the authorities contact David and basically, he went and met with them, and they believed enough of his story to put him as an undercover person. And so they set him up with a fully loaded audio and video equipped car. And they were like, go get the girls in the car. Just talk to them. And he had this car for months. And he was just trying to, like, get them to open up.
Oh, God.
So.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Over the next few weeks and months, he talked to the girls separately in the car, and he was able to capture their confessions. Sandra said, honestly, it was at just such a point where it was either her or me, and I'm younger. I felt like I had more potential.
I wouldn't disagree.
She was 43. Like, I know, it's bad. It's not good. But it was not her or her mother. Like, she was not going to die because her mother drank a lot. I promise. She needed to move out. And she was 16 and she could.
There's such a level of, yeah, she can, but her mother, who's so incredibly toxic and non-functioning, has never been able to give her the tools and resources and, like, emotional stability that she needs to be able to go and do that.
Yeah, but she's not four languages. Like, this girl was not stupid.
No, but there's a difference between being stupid and being smart and efficient.
Yeah.
Not you can speak four languages, but you can also be like a dumb little teetotter, like people that we know who are so smart and are incapable of making good decisions.
Right.
Because they don't know.
But at the end of the day, it was not her mother will die or she will die. That was not a thing that was going to happen.
Her mom was not threatening her life. No.
It wasn't enriching her life in any way, but it was not her or her mother. And I will die on that cross.
Not everybody is strong like you are.
Well, she could have tried a little bit.
I'm not trying to sympathize with her. I'm saying I understand how this situation got to where it was.
Yeah, I can understand that thought, like that spark, but I don't understand how it could get to a point where you kill another person. Not when there were options. And there was an aunt that would have helped them. There was David and his parents who were close with Linda and saw the alcoholic tendencies. There were options.
Yes. These girls killed their mom. Yes. But how many people dropped the ball in protecting vulnerable humans from this one? David, if his parents were close, then they knew what the situation was like. Mm-hmm. Why didn't they call the police? Why didn't they contact the school? Why didn't the people at social services take them seriously and follow up the way that they should have? There were so many, like, safety nets. Mm-hmm. So situations don't get to this.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that, like, oh, yeah, they definitely were right in killing her.
Yeah.
I'm saying that there were a lot of people who dropped the ball who contributed.
Yeah.
To this.
I think knowing what I have researched about Sandra, she didn't have more potential than her mom. Like, she was showing up drunk to school, showing up drunk to everywhere. She was not participating in any way that was more valuable than her mother.
Our behaviors are learned.
Yes, they are. But that doesn't make her have more potential. But
it doesn't give her the power to make the choice.
No. Like, and that's, I think, the thing is that these girls felt like they were God, and they got to make that choice.
Yes.
And that's not...
That's where the issue is. Right. Yeah.
So, January of 2004, a full year after the murder, the girls were arrested and questioned. The media originally dubbed them as the Pajama Girls because they were arrested around 7 a.m., and the girls refused to change into regular clothes. So, they didn't know, like, what that would mean for them. But they just were like, I'm not changing into regular clothes. Like, I'll go in this.
Yeah.
But the media twisted it into these innocent children.
That they arrested in the dead of the night. Yep. That had, yeah.
One media outlet went so far as to say, they arrested these children while they were still in bed and they didn't even get to take their teddy bears with them.
Oh. What a remarkable way that the media skews the public's perspective on a situation.
Before you get the judge's, like, hand down on it. Like, they didn't even know what the whole story was.
What they were arrested for.
Right.
No.
So, all they see is these two little girls being pulled out of their house in their pajamas.
Oh, God.
Oh,
God. Okay.
Yeah. So they were dubbed the Pajama Girls. The questioning did not go well.
No shit.
Sandra kept telling the detective she wouldn't say anything, but then would give stuff away. So she would be like, jibber jabber, jibber jabber, I'm not telling you anything.
But, like, also, what if she did drown and I held her head down? But, like, also, I'm not going to tell you what happened, but, like, also, I gave her booze.
100%.
Okay.
That's basically how this conversation went down. And it was hours and hours of investigation, like, or of interrogation. Yeah. So her breaking point was when she realized that in order to save Beth, she was going to have to say something.
Fuck.
So they were basically like,
where's the brother?
He's with his dad.
Okay.
I think the brother went with their dad the weekend of the murder, and then the brother was their half-brother.
So they had split custody.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, like, he just, like, lived with his dad then.
Thank God.
Yeah.
That he had a secondary, yeah.
He had, like, a solid chance at life. So, basically, in order to save Beth, Sandra had to confess that Beth didn't have anything to do with it and she did it. Beth, on the other hand, held steady in her rhetoric that they had nothing to do with the crime.
Good job, Beth. Yeah. I mean, not good job, Beth, but, like,
in the
trying to get away,
scheme of things, if you're like, stop talking!
If you're trying to get away with a murder, listen, the rule, if you get arrested, listen, listeners, why am I addressing you? That made me feel super weird.
Friends,
y'all, listen, if you ever get arrested for anything in the entire world, your number one job is to shut the fuck up.
Mm-hmm.
You shut the fuck up. You don't have to tell them shit.
Yep.
You don't even have to be under arrest. You can be pulled in for questioning. Shut the fuck up.
Yep.
And get a lawyer.
So what's interesting here is that in the United States, that is definitely our go-to. As soon as you get arrested, you're like, I plead the fifth.
Yeah, you shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Because we will implicate you with made up evidence.
Canada doesn't have that rule. So they have a suggestion, basically, that says if a person being interrogated says, I invoke my right to silence, they don't immediately have to stop questioning.
Can it be admissible in court?
No.
Okay, that's the thing. Yeah.
So
anything after, like, if you're like, I plead the fifth, and like, did you kill your mom? And you're like, yeah. That's not admissible in a court of law.
It's up to the judge, basically,
to
say if that is admissible or not.
Okay.
So in this case, both Beth and Sandra invoked their right to silence. I think Beth did it like 17 times and Sandra did it like 25 times in their like 8-hour questioning.
Invoked their right?
Uh-huh. And they just kept at them, basically. And
but that's not admissible. That's not, well,
but
I don't know.
But it's up to the judge.
Fuck the judge.
It's not like our legal system where we know hard stop. As soon as you say, I want a lawyer, all questioning stops.
Yes.
They know that
they can push the limit.
Mm-hmm. And it just depends what judge you get.
For some reason, that makes me really appreciate the Constitution.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So in this case, it was not admissible in court. So the judge said, like, that whole questioning is thrown out.
Good.
So, however.
Oh.
These ding-dongs. I can't. The police were like, okay, here's the plan. We're going to put them in a room together because they kept them separate for like 12 hours.
Oh, put them in the same holding cell.
They're dying to talk to each other.
Fuck me.
So they put them in the same holding cell and told both of them that their conversation would be recorded and monitored. So do with that what you will. These girls were like, we speak in Dutch.
So they're the only two in the world who speak in Dutch. They can't find a translator?
They honestly, truly, in their hearts, felt like the police were too stupid to translate into Dutch. And this whole conversation was like, what have you said so far? This is what I said. This is what you said. Here's our story. Here's the new plan. They can't know we killed Mom.
Oh, too bad there's not a whole ass country or two that fucking speaks Dutch.
Yeah. So this conversation was also thrown out, but it is there.
I'm sorry. Jesus Christ.
Okay. They're 15 and 16.
They're probably like, no worries. We know Pig Latin.
100%. Like, they were just like, oh my God, what if we write each other a note in hieroglyphs that we made up ourselves?
Oh my God. Did you tell the police that she was ordered, May?
Oh God. So the police finally did like a search warrant of the homes and retrieved the computers from the sisters as well as all of their friends.
Christ.
There were 14,680 hits on the word drown. Yep. There were 247 hits on the word Tylenol.
Oh my.
Yeah.
God, I'm not trying to laugh. This is honestly a tragic story, but it's like, so fucking bad. Come on.
It goes from being like so mind-bogglingly stupid to like having like such hard in-depth conversations about like what's right and wrong and like how we get ourselves into these situations that it's completely horrible.
Fuck me, Tay.
I know.
Okay, go on.
Okay, so the girls are put into, like, juvenile detention centers for, like, 3 or 4 months while the investigations happen. And they're granted bail after a few months.
They're not remanded?
No.
Weird.
Yeah.
Well, they're minors. What's Canadian law on that?
So, normally, if they were adults, they would not have been granted bail, especially with their knowledge of language. And their passports. And they had family in Europe. So
who'd like, they get released to?
Their aunt, Martha.
Okay.
So the girls get granted bail and they're on house arrest. Beth and Sandra, like, taught other prisoners or other, like, people in the juvenile detention center. They taught yoga. They were, like, model citizens. So the judge was like,
yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Okay, but so was
great.
Edmund Kemper. Yeah. But, okay.
So, in August of 2004, the police had enough evidence to arrest Justin for conspiracy to commit murder because he supplied the Tylenol 3s. Huh. August of 2004, again, they interviewed Ashley. She admitted that she should have gone to the police and that she did know about the murder ahead of time. But they did not charge Ashley with any crime because she agreed to testify against the sisters, and so did Jay and Chad.
Okay.
The girls decided they wanted to be tried by the judge alone and no jury.
Okay, like a bench trial?
Yeah. The prosecution had heaps of evidence against the girls, as well as the testimony of many of their friends. The defense's position was this. It was a macabre class project, How to Kill a Mother. It was a fable that became the deadly truth as a result of a tragic accident. So they're just trying to spin it like weird coincidence that this happened. Just after noon on December 5th of 2005, so a whole nother year, the verdict came down. Justin was charged with conspiracy to commit murder and had a separate trial ahead of him. He served one day. One day.
In jail?
Mm-hmm.
One day?
Yeah, he appealed his judgment the next day and was released.
I've had friends in the drunk tank for longer.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're about to get real upset. Okay. The judge said of the girls, these two defendants set out to commit the perfect crime, but instead they created the perfect prosecution. The case against them is overwhelming. It is possibly the strongest case I've ever seen in 30 years of prosecuting, defending, and judging criminal cases. I find the defendants guilty as charged of first-degree murder.
Ooh, first degree.
Mm-hmm. So finally they get sentenced in June of 2006. They were sentenced as minors.
Were they tried as minors?
the trial really doesn't, like,
okay,
matter. It's how you're sentenced.
Okay.
So they both wrote letters to the judge, like, pleading to be charged as minors. They're 17 and 18 at this point. If they were sentenced as minors, which they were sentenced as minors, the maximum sentence you can get as a minor is 10 years, no matter what crime you commit in Canada. So they were placed in secured custody for 6 years and would be released in open custody or house arrest for 4 years. They were both released after for good behavior after 3. Released, like, into the public. No house arrest.
Oh.
Because they are minors, their identities will be forever a secret. Beth and Sandra are not their real names. Linda is not her their mother's name.
No. Taylor. No, wait. Yeah. My body. I have goosebumps on it.
They are 30 and 31, and they live in regular fucking society. And nobody knows who they are. And that is the horribly tragic, extra horrible story of the bathtub killers of Canada.
Fuck me.
You see why I got down a whole ass rabbit hole? Oh
my God. I'm horrified. Listen, yeah. You told me bathtub killers. I thought it was just going to be like some fucking dude cutting up bodies, putting it down a drain. This is not what I fucking thought.
No. Mm-mm. I'm really sorry.
No, it's... I think there's so many, like, important issues in that to take account for. Like, one, where's the fucking adults?
Right. I have one last thing to add.
Oh, okay. Go on.
Okay, so if you or anyone that you know is struggling with suicide, I want to put out the Prevention Helpline out there. It is 1-800-273-8255. And if you're struggling with alcohol addiction or anyone you know, the number is 866-293-7031. That's it.
Important numbers.
Get help. Please don't kill anybody.
No. Ugh. No. There's always a better way.
There's always a way out. Even if it seems so dark.
Even if you don't see the way out, there's a way out.
Yep.
There, unfortunately, are really terrible, heartbreaking situations that people live in.
Yeah.
And you either are working hard to get strong and rise above it and continue on, or you get caught in a toxic cycle.
Yeah.
And I think that this is an example of being caught in that toxic cycle. And I think there were ways.
There were definitely ways to not let that happen. I understand how it happened, and that I'm sure that they felt like they couldn't reach out to anybody and nobody believed them. And there were things that I left out, like in sophomore year, Sandra made up a lie that she and Jay had sex and she was pregnant with Jay's baby.
Fuck me.
And Jay helped her spread this lie. And they did it because Sandra wanted attention from this other boy in high school. So the school was used to their lies.
They were problem... I hate to say it, but, like, problem kids from the get-go.
Right. And so, like, them saying, like, our life is terrible, we need help. I think a lot of these people, like, looked back on some of their other lies and missteps and mistakes and said, this can't be true either, or it's not as bad as they're making it.
I think there's something that happens when, like, you live in a situation like that that causes you to be a pathological liar because it... you create your own reality that you then believe, and it provides some relief. But then in the midst of that, how do you sort out the actual trauma that they're living through with their bullshit?
Yeah. So the book by Bob Mitchell, he has the take of very much like the law-abiding citizen, probably a little bit more my skewed of a vision. Criminal, does criminal act, needs to be put away. the movie takes a very empathetic approach to the girls and shows them in a different light. So the movie is told from their perspective. And the movie is brilliant. I watched the movie a few years ago before I knew that this was like a really true story. Mm-hmm. And it shows the girls' delusion so well. And it shows that they have kind of a, like almost a psychic connection in their delusions, where one girl starts to believe something and the other girl immediately follows. It's fascinating.
But what toxic relationship is it that they were shown? That's how they grew up? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that there's really something to be said about... There's that whole saying where, like, an eye for an eye. Mm-hmm. But an eye for an eye is not always justice.
Right.
And serving an eye for an eye is not always fair.
Sometimes it's vengeance. And vengeance and justice are two very different things.
Well, and it's... We seem to have this, like, issue with, like... equity, mm-hmm. where their lives are ruined because they ruined somebody else's lives, but like how much did the life that they end ruin them mm-hmm. to begin? You know what I'm trying to say? Yeah. It's like it's a gray area.
Yeah.
It's hard.
It's an ethical case for sure.
It is. And I think unsurprisingly, you and I are falling on different sides while still mm-hmm. simultaneously being the same person.
Listen, we warned y'all that this was going to happen.
It's happening now.
If you are surprised in any way, shape, or form, go back and listen to a little bit about us.
Go watch go see the photo of Taylor exercising while I eat Taco Bell in my car that we posted on Facebook.
Chinny and I are the same person, but sometimes we're just a little bit opposite.
Right.
But we're still going to like hang out and drink together after this, so.
Well, yeah. It's what best friends do.
Yeah. So we love cases like this because of that conversation that comes from them. And we've heard that other people are having conversations like around some of these ethical, the ethical stories we're telling. So that fascinates us greatly.
I'm glad that there's like a conversation to be had there.
Absolutely.
And that hopefully you and I are starting other conversations.
Yeah.
About it with people. Thanks for, you know, listening. This has been kind of a heavy episode.
Yeah. It's been long. Sorry.
If you made it here, you know.
Congratulations.
Congratulations. Thank you.
You deserve a high five.
Yeah.
Gold star by your name.
Yeah. Go treat yourself to something nice.
Go treat yourself. Go follow us on the things. We're on Instagram, Twitter. We have a Gmail. Mm-hmm. If you want to send us your stories, it's all pretty much a little bit grim.
Instagram, a little bit grim pod, Twitter, a little bit grim pod one, Facebook, a little bit grim, Gmail, a little bit grim @gmail.com.
Yeah.
So do the things, write us if you love us. If you don't love us, just like don't do anything and go away. That's fine.
Yeah.
You're not going to hurt our feelings.
Rate us, subscribe. It helps us so, so, so much. And we will screenshot and send each other, like, we got a new follower. Like, a single one of you will bring us so much joy.
We had a stranger join the Facebook group the other day, and Taylor and I had a video chat about it.
100%.
It was very exciting.
I was like, do you know this person? She's like, no, do you know this person? And I was like, no. And we had to have, like, heart feels about it.
So.
Love you so much.
Thank you for listening. Tune in.
Next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.